Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome to another edition of Reconstruction, the weekly Construction Index podcast with me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. It's Tuesday, the 1st of September 2020, which I've heard people say is the first day of autumn. But that doesn't sound right to me, Phil. What do you think?
Well, it feels like the first day of autumn weather-wise.
It's
normally
nippy,
September's nice and warm. We're used to having warm Septembers in recent years, certainly in the southeast of England. But it does in very many ways. It feels like summer is over.
It is a little bit
prematurely, autumnal. Perhaps.
Well, I checked actually. I was puzzled by this because I always thought that the 1st of September cannot be the first day of autumn, because it normally isn't, you know, the leaves aren't falling off the trees and stuff like that. So I checked with the Met Office, and there's meteorological autumn and there's astronomical autumn, and that's why. The Met Office likes to divide the year up into nice three-month chunks, and so autumn starts in September and goes on through October and November. But astronomically, of course, it's not quite the same as that. And astronomical autumn doesn't start until the 21st of September. So I'm clinging on to that one. I'm not going to give up on summer just yet.
Well, I'm interested you talk about astronomical and meteorological years, because I got thinking, with it being the 1st of September today, feeling a bit sort of philosophical, it seems the start of a new, more than a new season, but a new year. And our calendar year starts on the 1st of January, which always seems wrong. It's too close to Christmas, so it's not really the start of anything. Our new year should either be the 1st of September, or at least whenever you decide autumn starts, because it's sort of the end of summer and the start of something a little bleaker.
I agree.
Or it should be the 1st of April, or when the crops start sprouting, or the asparagus season begins or something. It should be the beginning of something, not some random week after Christmas.
I don't know. But of course,
both schools and companies take my line that, I mean, the financial year, the tax year, traditionally starts in April the 1st.
Yes.
A lot of companies have their financial year ends at different times, but the tax year is beginning of April, and the school year starts in September.
Yeah, that's right. I've never thought of it like that. You're quite right, though.
The big story in the news this week, of course, is the schools all going back.
Yes.
Or supposedly.
Supposedly going back, yeah. Well, they do. I think in Wales they go back today, and I think some schools in England go back today as well. My wife is a teacher, actually. She doesn't go back until Thursday. She's got two inset days, and then the children come back, or some of the children come back on Monday. So,
how's she feeling about it? Is she going to be masked up, or is she phlegmatic or fearful? Or
She's not looking forward to it. Let's put it that way. She'd much rather carry on doing everything remotely. The difference is, of course, I mean, we shouldn't really be spending too much time talking about education, but it is significant because it ties in with so many other sort of human activities. In schools, of course, the teacher normally sits in their classroom and the children go from classroom to classroom for their lessons. But they've decided they can't do that now. And I assume that this is true in most schools, certainly in my wife's school. They say it's far better that the kids stay where they are. You don't want hundreds of kids milling around in corridors going from lesson to lesson. So the kids stay in the classroom and the teachers go from classroom to classroom, which, of course, isn't very popular with a lot of teachers, because their classroom is their realm. They decorate their classroom, they put up their posters and various other resources which are fundamental to the way they teach. They're all sort of put in place in their classroom, so they've got to drag a load of material around with them as well, going backwards and forwards between classrooms, all kitted out in face visors and masks and all the rest of it. So I don't think it's going to be much fun, let's put it that way. She's certainly not looking forward to it, I can tell you that.
And I can imagine the kids might get quite restless if they're sitting in the same chair for an entire morning. They don't get to sort of stand up every whatever it is, 45
stretch
minutes
her legs,
or an hour.
So, yes, I think it'll, well, you know, we'll wait and see what happens, but it's going to be a very different world that they're going back to.
Well, it's not just schools that are going back, of course. The offices are supposed to, the government is trying to get people back into offices.
Yes, that's right, which I think is very strange.
Why? Why do you think it's strange?
Well, because one of the revelations of the lockdown has been how successful it can be to work remotely. A lot of people, obviously not everybody, but only people, generally speaking, in an office environment, people who do desk work, can actually work quite effectively and very productively at home on their own with a computer and a mobile phone and an internet connection. And they don't have to commute for hours every day, travelling into city centres to work in offices. And I think a lot of employers appreciate the fact that this is perhaps a new way of operating. And the government, I got the impression that the government, I can't remember them saying anything specifically about this, but I got the feeling that the government thought this was a good idea as well. And then all of a sudden they say, oh no, we've got to get people back into the offices because actually the commute and the population of the economic zones in cities and towns is actually an important component of the economy. And I think one of the examples, perhaps the most obvious example, is the sandwich shop. That everybody stops off to get a sandwich on the way into work because that's going to be their lunch. And so Pret-a-Manger and other chains like that, not to mention the independents, have been suffering, obviously, because they haven't had that footfall and they haven't had the business rolling in. And I think the government, rather like the way they reacted for the hospitality sector and introduced the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, which of course ended yesterday, but was successful, they've decided, oh, there are people who do eat out, but they eat on the hoof. And we've got to help the people who cater for that sector as well. So I think that they feel, obviously they're not going to introduce the same sort of initiative, but they say, oh, we must get people back into offices because so many other businesses depend upon the flow of people into and out of city centres.
But these sandwich bars are chain, I mean, sandwich shops have always existed, of course, but yeah, the big growth of them and the Pret's and so on is only a response to changing markets and changing trends. In the olden days, lots of workplaces had their own staff canteens,
yes,
or whatever,
yeah,
and you ate in the workplace and they all shut down. So, therefore, 1,000 Pret's and sandwich bars sprung up. So it seems slightly strange that government policy should be dictated by what is, after all, perhaps a transient marketing trend of high street sandwich bars.
Yeah, I think that's probably true because once upon a time, of course, people would make their own sandwiches and take a lunchbox to work. That was the way you did it. That's what you did. But yeah, I agree with you. It's a relatively recent phenomenon. I don't see that they necessarily need to bolster that particular sector. Maybe they can find other ways of operating, I don't know.
But I do have slight concerns about everyone working from home or there not being an office environment to go back to, because while it's fine for greybeards like you and I who know what our work and our daily output is going to be and what's expected of us and we can get on and do it, there are, particularly this time of year, a generation of, whether they're apprentices or graduate trainees, new starters, school leavers, who are looking for work, and in the olden days, they would be, olden days, in 2019, they would be taken on, start work, and they might be on some sort of scheme or have be shadowing someone or have a mentor working alongside them, and they would be part of a team and get to learn what their job involves. And
you can't really do that remotely.
Well, no, you can't. I mean, you can. I mean, there is remote education, of course, and that has been going on and will continue, I guess. But essentially, if you want, you know, to train the next generation of, you know, whether you're talking about quantity surveyors or solicitors or salespeople who are ultimately going to be on the road, travelling from company to company doing sales pitches, at some point they need to be in a team situation with colleagues, with senior colleagues, mm-hmm. to see senior colleagues, to understand behaviours which should be role-modelled before them.
Yeah.
You can't pick that up just by watching your boss sitting in his bedroom on Zoom.
No, that's true. I suppose people do have to get back to work. Obviously, they need to get back to work. And sometimes it does mean that you have to work with other people. I mean, my daughter's a trainee surveyor. She was furloughed for most of the lockdown. And she's back at work now for 3 days a week, only one of which she's allowed to go into the office. But that is the day that she looks forward to, because she feels she's still learning. 2 days she's on her own and a little bit adrift, I think. That one day she goes into the office, that's when she gets grounded again. She can touch base with her boss. She can speak to her colleagues. And there's that interaction now that she used to have 5 days a week. And
this is a great point. Now, tell me more about what was she doing before COVID, before lockdown, last year? When did she start her training? What did the training process involve before?
Well,
she'll have her on. Is she there?
No, she's not. She's coming back tomorrow, though. She's coming back to see us for a few days. She lives in London. She works in the West End. She is a graduate surveyor, and she is working towards her professional qualifications. So what she does, it is very important that she works with other people. She's on rotation, so she's working in different departments. She's doing valuation at the moment, for example. I should be able to trip off the tip of my tongue the various different activities that she has to experience, but she has to rotate between different departments in the practice in order to get a rounded education. Basically, she needs that experience. So she's shadowing people. She is working with a different boss on a sort of a 3-monthly basis, and she can't do that if she's sitting at home. You know, she's
unless she puts webcams in their rooms and stalks them.
Even that, I don't even know if that's quite the same sort of thing. I mean, a lot of it was actually requires her to go out on site and meet clients and interact with other people to actually learn how the business is run and how the job is done. And a lot of it is site-based.
And is that a 2-year process or a 3-year process?
Well,
normally 2-year charter?
I think it's normally a 2-year process. Actually, she's had to extend it because of the lockdown, obviously. So she's unlikely to qualify until the back end of next year.
And that presumably is going to be the case for all junior, you know, trainee doctors, architects,
I'm sure it is.
Anyone who's working towards professional qualification has to put it back a year, I guess.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So I for you and I, working from home is just normal. And for a lot of people who do fairly routine desk work, it's a gift. And I know a lot of people who do office work, desk work, they just love working from home because it's so much easier. But yeah, some jobs you cannot do like that. You've got to be out there. You've got to be speaking to people.
But I dare say your daughter's bosses could carry on working from home ad infinitum. Meanwhile, she'd be training ad infinitum and never get chartered because she's not able to do what she needs to do to get chartered.
Yes, that's true. I mean, there are some bosses. I know some of her bosses spend an awful lot of time working from home. It's been quite routine for them for a long time. But again, their job is largely managerial. It's not quite as hands-on as the more junior people, you know, as their job is. They're the ones that, if you like, at the sort of client-facing side of things. There are people, obviously, in that profession who can quite easily work remotely. But for a lot of them, especially when they're working towards their professional qualifications, that they need that interaction. They do need that mentoring and that experience of dealing with a client on a daily basis.
I mean, like you, I'm a huge advocate of working from home. I do it myself, like yourself. Get far more done in a day than ever did before.
Yes, yes.
And it's just much more productive, effective, efficient, and so on. But organisations, I think, which rely solely on working from home, will wither on the vine. They will have no scope for new blood. And I think what may happen is what you're suggesting is some of the big bosses may think, well, I can do my job from home. I'll stay at home, and I've got a big enough house where I can have a home office and space for it. And all the younger people who are perhaps still in house share situations or bedsits or small one-bedroom apartments or whatever and haven't got anywhere practical to have a home office and who can't even do their job at home because they're still in training mode, it's not... The bosses have to model behaviour. They have to turn up. They have to be there. If they expect the next generation coming through to be as capable as they have been?
I suppose a lot of businesses perhaps have prospered or at least thrived to a certain extent from being able to have a lot of people work remotely from home, saved them a lot of money in many ways, and perhaps even had a more motivated workforce. And in fact, the big news this week, which I know that you're itching to talk about, is that there has been a very interesting study about the effects of the COVID-19 lockdown on the construction sector and the impact it's had on productivity. And I think for many people, the results of it might be quite surprising.
Yes, you're talking about this Loughborough University study.
Yeah.
COVID-19 and construction, early lessons from a new normal. This was interesting. Three researchers from Loughborough University, they studied some sites of Balfour Beatty, Kier, Mace, Morgan Sindall, Skanska and GKR Scaffolding. I don't know whether it was all different sites or five or six sites. I believe the Skanska site was Humber Tunnel. I don't quite know which of the other sites were, but I don't think it's particularly relevant what the sites were. But the findings overall suggest that while total output on the sites went down during lockdown, during the sites were visited in August, so they're obviously looking at the report came out in August, so I guess that they were looking at it during the peak of lockdown
and
the return to work under the site operating procedures. While overall output was down, output per person, at least in some cases, appears to have gone up. For example, I mean, the quotes are 50% workforce reduction, but only 30% reduction in output. Companies on site had found new ways of getting things done. So you could get what used to take 10 people to do, they're now getting done with only 7.5 people. It may have taken longer, but it was done more efficiently.
Does it surprise you at all, that result?
I think it does. And it surprises me that it happened so quickly. I can imagine over time companies getting better at managing the constraints, but they seem to have adapted to the constraints really quickly.
Yeah.
And they produced a chart, if I can pull it up, a graph, I don't know the correct name for these graphs, it's a flow chart, showing that COVID-19 is the trigger of it all, but it's not it's the illness. It's the social distancing that is required because of the illness.
Yeah.
And the impact of social distancing, there were four essentially that they had on sites, it meant there were fewer workers, increased working from home and remote meetings. It also meant that sites had to be redesigned. Mm-hmm. I don't think that means the finished building. That means the layout of sites, the way you work and how you
and
get
the flow
into
of
it
people
and the
around.
Traffic.
But yeah.
That, exactly what I mean. Yeah. And it also necessitated improved planning because if people were arriving at different times on site to avoid peak hour transport, you had to say, right, well, we'll do job A first and then job B and so on. By doing this, it meant that there was improved housekeeping, fewer trades on top of each other, colliding. Mm-hmm. It's more sequential work rather than simultaneous work.
Yeah.
And less time hanging around chatting to your mates.
Yeah.
Because your mate probably wasn't there.
Well, that's it. I found that was a sort of maybe an unexpected benefit because, of course, a lot of sites are put in like a one-way system. So you're not passing people in a corridor or on a walkway. You're actually all travelling in the same direction. And so you're not stopping because you see Bob coming in the opposite direction and you haven't seen him for a couple of days. And you stop and say, how are you doing? You know, what's been going on? All the rest of it. You don't do that because he's not coming in the other direction. He's going in the same direction as you. So you don't have a chance to stop and chat on the stairwell or wherever it might be.
In the short term, I can absolutely see that's it's a great thing. It cuts out the waste and inefficiency of human interaction. In the long term, it's a bit like, you know, we've read these newspaper reports or often it's things put out by trade unions about these dreadful, often they're Amazon warehouses or JD Sport warehouses or these big companies where people have got these sort of shelf unstacking, I suppose, jobs. And the rules that they have to follow in some of these places, it's so tight that you're only allowed so many minutes for a toilet break, for example, or, you know, you've got to be on the go the whole time and maximum efficiency and everything's like piecework. And you can see that is what makes the company successful and profitable, But equally, I'm sure in other places, it can probably make it a fairly miserable work environment.
Yeah.
And it may not be good for staff turnover. And offices need, you know, you need the water cooler moment, the place where you stand around the photocopier and say, oh, did you see that, you know, what was on telly last night,
yeah,
or whatever. And while it's annoying to those who aren't involved in those conversations and are trying to get on with work, it's part of, it's not really work-life balance, but the workplace culture requires human interaction.
Yeah.
And if you eliminate that completely, can you afford to?
I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, one of the things I didn't like about working in an office was the sort of random interactions with people when I was trying to do things. I had a line manager whose idea of being a line manager was to come along and perch on the edge of my desk when I was up against the deadline. And that was not productive, I can tell you.
Was he one of those people who just put one buttock on your desk?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Hate that.
Yeah, just come along, perch on the edge of the desk and say, how's it going then? And I said, well, you know, I've got a file copy in half an hour, sort of thing. So
you,
that's the sort of thing I
desk
didn't like. But at the same time, it must be miserable if you go to work, you clock on, and I have done jobs where I've had to literally clock on and clock off, and you do feel like you're on a sort of treadmill. It doesn't create a relaxed environment. It does perhaps engender a certain amount of resentment, perhaps. I mean, certainly I know one or two organisations have actually suffered as a result of that. People, you know, they have a demotivated workforce, and it's no, you know, it's like being on a you know, a Roman galley. You know,
this Loughborough study actually found the opposite in the short term. It said that there seems to be a sense of, hey, it's an emergency, we're all rallying together here,
yeah,
it's a new situation. And workforces appear, on the whole, these are generalisms, but on the whole, there seems to be a great sense of in it together,
yeah,
and we'll get it done and we'll work it out.
Well, there's nothing quite like
do whatever.
Yeah, there's nothing quite like a looming disaster to focus the mind. And if
we've talked about that before,
yeah,
but the question is how can you maintain that? How can you translate,
yeah,
that initial sense of urgency into the new normal? And that's going to be the challenge. I think there has to be some sort of middle ground found to,
yes,
re-inject a sense of community to the workplace while also maintaining the get on and do the job.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, the more comfortable you get at work, perhaps the more complacent you become. When the lockdown was announced, just about everybody was thinking, what does this mean for me and my job? And so when construction sites did open up again, obviously a reduced workforce, but a workforce nonetheless, was allowed back to work, they probably thought, blimey, this is, you know, I thought this wasn't going to happen. I'm sure a lot of them were thinking, you know, it could be me who's on furlough or being laid off. But here I am, I've got my job back. And perhaps it was a bit of a shock to the system and they felt remotivated. But as you say, it's difficult to sustain that. When somebody's had a bit of a shock to the system, yeah, they'll step up and they'll go the extra mile and perhaps be a little bit more aware of what's going on around them and what and the reason that they're doing what they're doing. But once they get the job security back and things return to normal, they won't have that sense of urgency anymore. So maybe the actual mechanisms that have been brought in could be retained. You know, maybe the one-way systems around the site. And there are some aspects in this report which are clearly things which could be taken forwards and reused. I'm trying to think of a specific example. Staggering start times, more streamlined worker flow due to workers staggering their start times. And in fact, we've written about this in the magazine within the last couple of years. Did we not talk about it on the podcast recently about flexible working, that kind of thing?
Yes, we did. We did.
Here's a working example.
Yes, yes.
People have been doing
that.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So I think there are things which people have had to do and perhaps wouldn't have done otherwise that they've discovered have been successful, and they'll carry on doing them. So
there's another interesting learning point from this study that goes back to what we were talking about before, about who can work from home and who can't. Quoting from the report, that some of the sites, some of the workers on site, that did lots of interviews with all sorts of people on the sites, and said that some of them reported a lack of senior leadership visibility.
Mm.
The bedroom brigade, one interviewer called them, the bedroom brigade are all, you know, sitting at home while we're doing the real work kind of thing. And that has to be addressed. On the flip side of that, other senior managers who had no desk, no office HQ to go, well, the office HQ was still there, but it wasn't open or operating. But other big bosses, instead of going to HQ and sitting in the office managing the operations there, did get out and about and were more visible on site. And the Loughborough University authors say this needs to be more than just a token involvement. Senior managers working alongside frontline workers could be a brave but potentially game-changing initiative. Now that's really interesting. So are the big bosses, the CEOs or the you know regional managers, are they going to stay at home in their bedrooms, or are they going to be on site?
Well, there are some big bosses who do get out regularly and sort of walk around the sites and make themselves visible. And they tend to be the ones, I think, who are actually respected most by their workforce. I mean, it's no surprise, really, that, you know, if you are seen to be there rather than just sitting in your ivory tower issuing edicts from on high, then people will think, well, he's one of us, or, you know, he is doing the same job as us. We're working towards the same goal. They're bound to be more popular, and perhaps that will have a positive effect on productivity on site.
Yeah, it's a good report. And if you're interested in reading that report, there's a link to it from constructionindex.co.uk, our news story on it. The report's called COVID-19 and Construction, Early Lessons for a New Normal. And I noticed that some of the participants, maybe all of them for all I know, but I have seen that both Balfour Beatty and Skanska link to it from their sites, and I guess some of the other companies also do. There seems to be a lot of interest and support surrounding the findings of that study.
Yeah, and it is important, not just for people who actually work in the construction industry, but I mean anybody who's interested in the UK economy, it makes interesting reading. And of course, construction is one of our biggest and most important industries.
Apparently not.
Not according to Liz Truss.
Yeah.
So okay. Tell us about this one, Phil, because this is fascinating.
You've teed me up for this one. International Trade Secretary Liz Truss has launched 11 new trade advisory groups as part of a big business engagement drive, sort of to do with Brexit, of course, and sorting out our new trading relationships around the world. A little bit reading around the subject, I discovered that it seems to be on the back of a January 2020 paper from the CBI, which recommended that we needed 18 trade advisory groups, and she's come up with 11 for various different industrial sectors: agricultural and food, another one for automotive, aerospace and marine, another one for manufacturing and consumer goods. Then you've got investment. There's one for investment and one for financial services.
Yes, I found that strange.
I'm not sure about those. You've got life sciences, tech and telecoms, chemicals, professional advisory services, which I'd thought probably overlap with financial services a lot.
Yes.
Maybe, I don't know. But anyway, there's a separate one for professional advisory services, transport services and creative industries. And just have a look at the professional services. Is all seems to be lawyers, accountants. Lawyers and accountants, professional services. There's no architects or civil engineers or surveyors.
So the City of London features pretty prominently in this list,
of course,
doesn't it?
Yes. So essentially, you may notice, folks, there is absolutely no room for construction, building materials, housing, utilities, environmental sciences. Well, life sciences, I suppose, environmental sciences. But construction is significant by its absence, given that it's such a huge part of the economy.
It is astonishing, isn't it?
I sent an email to the Department of Trade saying, interesting that there's no construction group. What's all that about then? They said, sent me an email saying, this is for background only. I sound like I wasn't allowed to use this information, but for background, your background information only. These 11 groups represent specific sectors vital to the UK economy. The construction industry is not represented on the former expert trade advisory groups either. And we have, they say they've found place for some people from the construction industry in the manufacturing and consumer goods
club. I wondered about that, but
because we place such an impact on the construction, you know, such an impact, so much value on the input of the construction industry. So that's why we've got some. So I thought, construction name? I looked in closer detail at the names of people on the manufacturing and consumer goods advisory group, and they've all got about 10 or a dozen people, that sort of size of committees. And the manufacturing group does indeed include someone from the UK subsidiary of an Italian cable manufacturer and someone from the UK subsidiary of an Indian steel giant.
Okay.
And a foreign, the UK subsidiary of a foreign aluminium company as well.
Bit peripheral, now, really.
There are materials, but it's not your, it's materials for construction and everything else.
Yeah, of course.
They did say in their reply to the Department of Trade that Reed Steel were on this group, but they're not listed on the website as being on this group. Now, it wouldn't surprise me. Reed Steel, I would fully expect to be involved in this, because their MD, Simon Boyd, was a very vocal, drum-banging Brexiteer in the run-up to Brexit, and is a big cheerleader for Brexit. So I can see that he would be someone who the government would be keen to embrace,
yes,
and bring on board. He seems to be a loyalist for that, as far as they're concerned. But Reed Steel weren't involved on the weren't mentioned on the website. So essentially, even though the CBI report back in January did recommend an advisory group for construction and housing and another one for utilities and environmental services, not there. Construction is not on board.
What's your feeling for? I mean, what's your theory? Why do you think it's been left out? Do you think it's because, for example, they think building equals house building? We build houses in England and Wales. We don't build them in France and Germany.
Yeah. We don't export houses. Our contractors do work overseas, but not like they used to.
No.
I can't understand why our consulting engineers and architects are not on professional advisory services, because the Association of Consultancy and Engineering
absolutely
is got a massive international push, presence. I mean, it's a large part of what it does is exports, and its members do is exports. A lot of building materials are export. Now, I suppose government could say as they do that it's, well, that's just a wing of manufacturing. Mm. But equally, you could say that food production is a wing of manufacturing. Automotive and aerospace and marine are a wing
exactly.
of manufacturing.
Yes,
chemicals are a wing of manufacturing.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
And they've got their own categories. But to me, it's particularly strange because I think I've mentioned this before. The Construction 2025 government strategy document, which they published in, I believe, 2013, setting their goals for 2025, they wanted to bring down the balance of trade deficit in building materials and components from what was 6 billion in 2013 to 3 billion by 2025.
3 billion?
Well, three billion. They wanted to halve it. They
wanted to halve
the balance of trade deficit.
Yes, okay.
That's the target. The government target is to halve that 2013 deficit from £6 billion a year down to £3 billion.
Okay.
So far, however, it's gone up. The balance of trade deficit is currently at £10 billion. So it's nearly doubled and moving in completely the wrong direction. Our exports have gone up a little bit since 2013, but our exports have gone up rather a lot more. Sorry, our imports have gone up rather a lot more.
Hmm.
So the gap between materials we import and what we... In other words, we need to make more in this country in terms of building materials if we think that goal is important and the government has said that it does, and we need to export more of the building materials that we make in this country. Clearly, it's a key government strategy to export more building materials, but Liz Truss doesn't want an advisory group.
No, I find that strange. I mean, it can't just be an oversight, can it? It can't just be that they've missed this particular one. And now that we've had a call from Phil Bishop, we better do something about it.
As if. No, I think they had that probably started with the list that the CBI came up with of 18 groups and thought that's too many, which is a sound instinct to have. Don't want massive committees all the place. Maybe even 11 is too many. Why not put chemicals in with agri-food, and why not put
financial services and investment together?
Yeah. Exactly. With professional advisory services, you could put that down to basically manufacturing and services. You just have two advisory groups if you wanted to whittle it down. But they looked to see what they could whittle it down and decided that construction wasn't really an export thing. Mm. It also doesn't help, of course, that construction is partly sponsored by the Department, what I still call a DTI, but it's not Department of International Trade, but the Department of Business and whatever.
Yes,
business,
yeah, I know.
That one. obviously, the Department of Transport has a deal for looking after construction to a large extent, and the Ministry of Housing, mm-hmm. Communities, Local Government and Housing has got a big role and in interaction with construction. So construction has always...
dissipated.
Historically benefited and suffered from being spread across various different government departments as its sponsor. So there's no one particularly jumping up and down for it, perhaps as much as they should be in the way that other industries are.
Have you sought any feedback from the industry on this? Have you heard what anybody in the industry says?
I sent an email to the people I thought would be most agitated or stirred by this was the Construction Products Association, mm-hmm. who represent the obviously it sounds like the manufacturer of construction products.
Yeah.
No reply. Didn't hear anything back.
Really?
So they just feel that their involvement in other organisations, other channels is enough. Maybe they're having their own conversations with government at the moment through back channels and don't want to go public and don't want to rock the boat. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're all on furlough and aren't allowed to answer their emails. I don't know.
Yeah, if they're working from home, they can still do that, Phil. Well, that's...
No, not if you're on furlough. If they're working from home,
you can
answer
their email. Sorry, yes, absolutely.
But, there's been a lot of noise about the number of people on furlough who have actually been told by their bosses that, you may be on furlough, but you've still got to work. That was a story of a couple of weeks ago in the national papers. I haven't heard anyone in the construction industry doing that, but it's happening across the industry, across the economy, apparently.
Yeah, interesting. But, okay, well, that's most odd. I mean, I find that a puzzle, and I think it's a huge oversight.
That's always assuming, of course, that these advisory groups are going to achieve anything, and they're not a complete waste of time anyway. As we know, most committees tend to be a bit of a waste of time.
Well, do they have a worrying
signal being sent out by government there?
But do these advisory groups, do they have a distinct remit? I mean, are they expected to produce reports, or are they just going to advise government on an ad hoc basis? How are they going to work? How are they going to operate?
It sounds like there's an element of they're going to meet three times a year or mm-hmm. as required by developments during the free trade negotiations process. Their principal purpose is to provide the blend of strategic and technical expertise required to ensure that the United Kingdom's trade negotiations are able to progress at pace. That's what it says here.
Yes, all right then.
So... anyway,
yeah, government speak. Right. There we are. Okay. Well,
if you're wound up by that, folks, write to your MP.
Yes,
or
absolutely.
Write to us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Good stuff. Well, thank you everyone for listening once again to Reconstruction. We'll be back with you, David and myself, at the same sort of time. We're a day early this week, but we're normally on Wednesdays. Next week, you can read more about what we've been talking about at theconstructionindex.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find the latest issue of the Construction Index magazine in WH Smith and independent newsagents UK-wide. Use our store locator to find your nearest stockist today at theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine.